look at communications issues in Florida, and this is what we've learned from the two communications policy roundtables that we've had so far. The issues that jump out as kind of most pressing over the next several years have to do with, what are we going to do for consumer protection? What are we going to do with universal service? And what are we going to do with competition? Well, universal service we talked about yesterday. Today we're going to talk about consumers and about competition to give us kind of an idea of what it is that consumers are doing and where are they going and what their interests might be. We have Sean Carton, who will be our speaker this morning. He's the dean of the School of Design and Media at Philadelphia University in Pennsylvania. He founded one of Baltimore's first web development firms in 1995 and co-authored one of his first books about the web in 1993. He has more than 12 years' experience in doing media work and is well known for his expertise in what consumers are looking for in communications, media, products, and services. So without further delay, I'll turn things over to Sean.
Okay, thank you. Everybody can hear me, right? I wasn't going to use the microphone, but apparently if I don't, you'll get a blank tape at some point if you want to listen to this. But hopefully, when I gave my title for this presentation to the people at PERC, I probably didn't make the most exciting title. So I'm very glad you're all here, because I'm not sure if I would have seen the title on the agenda that I would have shown up in this room. But what I'm really going to talk about today is what was said before, and looking at, in terms of demographics, looking at where the changes are occurring. And a lot of it really is with younger people right now. But I'm probably going to tell you a little bit more about myself than I normally would. This is more about a speaker than you'll ever get today, because this is a shot inside of me of my shoulder, which I broke in many places last winter skiing in New York State. And I remember being on the slope, and I went down the slope, slipped down, fell down, was laying in a crumpled heap on the side. And as I looked around me, you know, I probably, this shows what kind of a geek I am, but as I was looking around me, I'm seeing all these like 12 and 18-year-olds and 15-year-olds flying down the slope. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, this is sort of a great metaphor for what a lot of people feel today, which is you're sort of laying there while the kids are kind of flying past you on this. So I thought it was a little bit instructive and kind of made me question my insanity for thinking that when I had a broken shoulder. But really, the thing is that things are changing very, very rapidly, and the world really isn't what it used to be. And looking at kind of some really major overall trends in terms of how things are changing, I think will say a lot about what's going on in the telecommunication industry and where we're going with this. I should also say that somebody mistook me for, I should have been in the power room today, so hopefully I don't look like a power guy. I'm not sure. But one of the things that I think is really interesting to look at, and my, just to back up a little bit, my real field of study is in how technology and culture interact with each other. And a lot of that is through the media, but also the way that the media is being delivered is something that says a lot about this industry. And one of the things I think is really interesting is that in terms of reaching people and connecting with people, there really is no major mass medium anymore. I mean, it used to be that we would look at television or look at radio and say, well, that's about all there is. But if you look at what's going on just on television, you know, the amount of television viewing share that has had, which is the number of people watching any one particular show on the average, has been declining precipitously, you know, since the 50s when it was a peak, when Milton Berle had a 79.9 share, which meant that nearly 80% of the people in the country were watching his show. Now down to the, I think the thing that was the highest rated television show in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years was this Monica Lewinsky interview, which got 40% of the people in the country watching it, which is even more than the Super Bowl on the average. But the point of all this is that people's attention is sort of starting to be drawn out to different places. And you look at what's going on, like with television, there's in terms of trends, TiVo sort of epitomizes what that whole thing is about, because it's no more that you're sitting there locked having three, you know, maybe four channels, maybe some of those weird UHF channels that nobody ever watched on there, but you've got this thing that can allow you to watch what you want when you want. You know, you have things coming up like IPTV, which will give basically sort of cable functionality to the internet, drawing people away somewhere more and giving people more options. And through all this, it's also difficult to say that in terms of mass culture and the way that people interact with things, that it's the same as it's always been, because it used to be that you could, you know, I think you could make a pretty good case that, you know, the limited number of channels people had to communicate and be communicated with was limited enough that culture would sort of spread more. Now you've got a lot more fragmentation. You know, and as part of that, the official story is kind of getting harder to find when, if you're trying to talk to your customers or when consumers are interacting with sort of the media sphere, it's harder to do that. It's harder to just get one story out because you've got things like, you know, blogs that are out there, companies that have, you know, employees blogging about them and talking about them. You've got email, and it's very porous. So, you know, and I think it's really jumping up that 8 million adults created blogs in 2004 and that you've got about at least 58% of internet users reading this thing. And you can see this through the war in Iraq and how that's been reported, that it's so much not the major media anymore that people are going to, but all these other things. So, you know, if you're looking at what today's consumers are doing, in terms of the internet, it's pretty amazing what the penetration is right now. You know, 3/4 of the population have access. 57% of people use it for communication, meaning really things like email, things like that. And then another large chunk is the browsing, shopping, and gaming that's going on. So people are turning their attention more than that. What I think is really interesting, too, is when you look at who they're communicating with, who people communicate with online, that you've got a lot of it. The biggest chunk is a lot of business use with clients and colleagues, friends, family, all the way down like that. But you know, the real balance up there is really individual people communicating with each other over this medium. And they're really connected through all these things. You know, they're blogging, they're instant messaging, which I'll talk about a little bit later on, gaming online, things like that. So, but to me, this is a really interesting thing that I think that has not really been talked about enough, is that for the 18 to 27-year-old demographic, and actually people who are younger than that, I couldn't get the statistic on that, but I've seen enough about that that it seems to be going that way, use instant messaging more than email. And I think that really indicates kind of a major shift in the way that people are using this, because when you're trying to communicate with customers or you're trying to communicate with potential customers, you know, email is seen as a really important thing to do, when in fact, you know, if you're trying to reach younger people, they're bypassing email entirely. I mean, my former business partner has a couple of teenage girls, and he said that they look at him when he talks about email like he's talking about, you know, the wind-up phone or something like that, because they just don't even go there. You know, you've got things like this that are coming out that allow instant messaging, you know, directly mobily, which, you know, is something that that really speaks to that demographic. You know, there was the whole brouhaha a little while ago about, you know, Paris Hilton's sidekick being hacked or something like that. But I think it was interesting that that's something that she was using and other people are. But when you look at, you know, the younger generation, which is really, like I said, what I wanted to talk about more, because that is where these major shifts are occurring first. You know, for the most part, the majority of them are still using phones, but then that instant messaging chunk really shows up there right now. The cell phone is the third one, and you can see as it goes on down, but email is still really small. There were, in terms of the text messaging, 2.5 billion text messages sent per month in 2004, which really shows a way that people are communicating, I think. And that there's a pretty good correlation between teenagers who use the internet and use text messaging. So 53%, and also in terms of how people are communicating, getting access to communications, is, you know, the rise of broadband. That 53% have broadband access, and I had to say work and home, because really, if you look at broadband at home, it still hasn't achieved over 50% penetration yet. Though, you know, you can see from this curve that it's really headed up there, and you know, who knows, by the next couple of months, it's even going to be that at home with people. But what you've got is, in terms of how consumers are communicating, you have this really intricate kind of web of things that you've got all these different channels that they're going through, they're stuck in the middle of, and some of these also go and will intersect with each other. So, you know, you've got mobile, meaning cell phones, but the instant messaging crossing with that, I think you can look at that as text messaging, you know, mobile web use, et cetera, but they're really not, you know, getting in touch with people, and the way that people have this sort of web of communication around them really is where all these intersecting pieces are right now. And all of this, I think, has really driven some major changes in the way that consumers are operating. You know, the first one, and this is sort of a, it's not all that subtle a point, but I think it's really important, is this idea that the consumer really wants control of their stream of information. I mean, people are very much about, you know, getting their media and their communications when they want and where they want, and in the way that they want them. If you look at the rise again of TiVo, the mobile video, all the things going on with that, it really is about people taking control of their own experience. Podcasting is another great example of this, because now it's, you know, you're no longer tied to whatever's on the radio, but you can take it with you. Or satellite radio, if you look at that, that's all about people being able to, you know, not necessarily pick whichever piece of media they want, but, you know, from hundreds of channels they can pick from that. And it's changed an awful lot of industries. I mean, pretty much there hasn't been any industry that hasn't been affected by the shift of people gaining control over their information and the power over that and how they change it. But in particular, you look at things like travel. I mean, you know, in general, very few people use travel agents anymore, because why would you? You know, you go on Expedia, you just get your information, you go. Something like medicine, in fact, has been changed drastically by this, and I think that you can see a correlation between the rise of direct-to-consumer advertising about certain drugs on television and the fact that people now feel much more empowered to take control of their own health care, because now they have the information. You know, every time you get a sniffle or a headache, you can go on WebMD and diagnose yourself with, you know, any one of a million different horrible diseases, or at least that's what I end up doing a lot of times. I always think I have sort of hemorrhagic fever or something on the way, but stuff like that. And in terms of consumer shopping behavior, you've got, you know, Frugal on Google and My Simon and some of these other things where, you know, anybody can go on, and the price of something is just an open issue that anybody can look at. You know, setting a price and hoping you're going to get it becomes much more difficult, because you can go on Frugal and say, show me all the thumb drives, that 1 gig thumb drives out there, and you'll get to the cheapest one right away. If anybody, you know, if you've bought a car any time in the past 5 years, you've experienced, at least 5 years, maybe longer, you've experienced this directly. You know, the fact that it used to be you'd go into the dealership and you'd sit there and, you know, you'd have this kind of ridiculous negotiation going on, and then it'd be, I'll go talk to my manager and come back. And, you know, it was that you didn't have the power in that relationship, because you didn't necessarily have all the information unless you were really savvy enough to go out and do a lot of research on your own. But I remember I bought a car probably, I guess it was about 5 years ago, and I thought that I was going to be, you know, the real tough guy and beat down this the salesperson. So I went online and got all this research. I brought it in. I had a big pack of paper in my hand. I walk in the door and start talking to the salesperson. He says, well, you look like you're a savvy consumer. He's like, well, you probably have the right price, but why don't you go over to our computers over there and sit down. We've got all our competitors bookmarked for you. You can check them out. If you find a better price, we'll match it for you. And I just was like, oh, my God, this really marks a major change, because no longer are they even fighting it. They're just saying, hey, we're just going to be part of it. There's probably not a car dealership in the world right now that doesn't have an, you know, sort of internet marketing manager on staff to be able to handle that stuff, because that's the way that people go back and forth. But it's a major shift from not having the power in the information to having the power in the information. People tend to feel that the more information they have, the more control they have, and the more of these devices that sort of allow them to go and carry their own stuff with them or interact with it or download it on the go or whatever, they feel more in control than people who don't. The other thing is this whole move, as Nicholas Negroponte from MIT Media Lab says, he calls it the move from atoms to bits, which is sort of from the physical world we're in into everything becoming information, increasingly becoming digitized. So, you know, you've got this move that I'm not entirely sure what that black thing is, but I've heard of them at some point. But, you know, you've got this move down from you know, vinyl records down to MP3s. And the fact, I think it was, actually, I was watching CNN in the room this morning, and the Apple iTunes store just sold its 1 billionth song online, which is astounding. I mean, a billion songs, and it's been, I guess, about 3 years. And it was funny, the kid who won it, they gave him, like, 10 iPods and a computer and a $10,000 gift certificate. So I kind of wish I had been buying iTunes stuff last night. But then on the bottom, you have this move in terms of video of moving from, you know, a couple of channels that you really couldn't control through, you know, there's digital cable you could fit in there, but down to things like TiVo, and now to, you know, some more downloadable online video. Again, you know, Apple has the iTunes store where they sold 1 million videos on their store when they when they opened it up in the first 20 days of operation, which is pretty astounding that that many people would be buying that. You know, and even, you know, this sort of move to atoms to bits also is really exemplified to me from, you know, the first downline that now gets projected on the television when you're watching football, because that thing isn't even there, you know, but it's changed the way that people really watch the game and think about the game, because all of a sudden you know all the time. You're not waiting for the chains to come out and go up on the field, but you can see for yourself exactly how things are going. There's also sort of this move of non-linearity or networks kind of being everywhere, that media consumption, everything else is moving to this. Again, back to that control issue, but I think this really started, and I like to think of the remote control as the real hero of the information age, because it really changed the way that people interact with media. And I just throw this chart up here because I think it's really funny, which is that your household income correlates directly with how often you change channels. So, you know, if you...
You don't break that down by gender?
I think we know who the channel changers are, but my point about that is, you know, you can sit there and say, well, honey, you know, I'm trying to adapt an affluent lifestyle. That's why I keep flicking around all the time. But, you know, but it really has changed the way that whole medium operates, just from the ability, again, to sort of have control and be able to move around wherever you want. This whole idea, too, of centralization is difficult. You know, very hierarchical structures that we used to have, things like that, this move to networks where it's much flatter organizations, email within organizations, the ability to sort of, if you have someone's cell number, to be able to call them at any time you want. That, you know, this is... this is actually the organization chart of the government of Maryland, which I got because I lived there. And, you know, I think this probably, I really love how they put citizens at the top. I know they're meaning well about that, but I've dealt with the MVA before, and I think the citizens box should be down at the bottom somewhere. But, you know, and this is just the tip of the iceberg from, you know, you've got this kind of thing to what's going on to this real organic growth. And I had a movie here, but it kind of got lost in the translation. But what it showed was this really, it's a movie that somebody made it, I forget what school they made it at, but it was this overtime growth of the internet, and it's amazing because it's like watching nerves develop. You know, you sort of have all these tendrils going out everywhere, that there is no real center to the thing. And also at the same time, you've got this going on. I thought this was really interesting that you know, worldwide there is a large number of DSL subscribers, and right now, just to kind of give you an idea of where it's happening. It's amazing to me. South Korea is number two, very just right below the United States in terms of this. And a lot of this growth is really happening in Asia right now, which is where I think it's interesting to go and sort of look at what some of the trends are through there. But wireless is also, you know, as you all know, a huge thing, and I think I've alluded to that before. But, you know, you've sort of got, and I don't know, maybe some of you work in offices that look like this, so I apologize for that. But, you know, you've sort of got these old hierarchically structured offices with everybody kind of sitting there and nobody connected and nobody talking to each other, you know, where that's necessarily the way it had to be. To today, we have things like, you know, Wi-Fi and, you know, coming, hopefully, hydrogen fuel cell batteries that I keep hearing are promised. You know, my laptop battery lasts about an hour and 10 minutes, so something that would keep it going longer would be good. But it's this whole idea of sort of disconnecting and being able to be everywhere at once. To me, this is where, you know, it really starts to show what's coming up in the future. You know, it, at this time, and I think this was actually a late 2004 study, that a quarter of 8 to 12-year-olds have mobile phones. I mean, that to me is just astounding. And if you look, and I don't know if there's anybody from Verizon in this room or anything, but, and there's a couple other carriers that now have cell phones designed directly for kids, that there's one called the Firefly, and I forget what the other one is, that basically you've got, you know, a mommy and a daddy button, and you've got a couple other buttons that can be programmed, but they're used to communicating. And you think about when this generation starts to come up more, they're going to have absolutely no expectation of not being able to connect with anybody they want at any time, anywhere. I mean, this is, you know, it's this major shift from, and this has come out in some other studies that I've seen about consumer behavior with wireless, is that there's a couple things. One is the shift from calling a place to calling a person. You know, there used to be that everybody would have on their answering machine, you know, you reach the so-and-so home or house or whatever. And now it's not really like that, because now what it is you can connect with anybody anywhere. And at the same time, there's a change that has occurred where there's sort of this culture of lateness now that has developed because of mobile phones, that because you can always get a hold of somebody if you're 15 minutes late, you know, whatever, you can just call them, hey, I'm on the way. And that happens all the time. And those are, I think, are just some of the initial kind of shifts that are happening. But when these people who, you know, are coming up with this start to be out there, their expectations are going to be much higher in terms of, you know, everything from performance to being able to connect reliably. Most common devices owned by people who are more technology people, high-speed internet, digital TV, cell phone with internet. I mean, this is really, you know, you can see where this is going. Now, this is a this was a study of, I'm trying to remember, but it was a sort of an early adopter study, I guess. And the adoption is expanding. I mean, I think this is amazing that 31% of people have played a mobile game in the past month. I mean, I sort of suspect, just based on what I've seen with people I know who have kids, that a lot of those numbers are, you know, stop crying, here's a game, go play it in the back seat and leave me alone. I don't know if it's actually those people. But, you know, the ringtone thing, again, with the younger demographic, I think is amazing, 50%. It's a multi-billion dollar industry just on the ringtone side. The number of subscribers who've sent and received text messages, 60% of users who took pictures, sent a picture, which to me was really interesting because it's not just about taking a picture to take with you, but it's about taking a picture and then sending it to somebody else. You know, again, that sort of expectation of connectivity and access. And that, you know, there's a smaller demographic of people who are accessing news and local info. But to me, the thing that's really interesting in this, because I didn't cross-reference it on this slide, but there's also, in terms of the internet, a major trend in how people are accessing information. It's not all about national stuff, that there's much more of a trend towards local news and information, which I think is a major opportunity. Just so you had some numbers here about how many people there were, I mean, it's a huge number of people who are doing this. The numbers in the projected reach are in the hundreds of thousands. So you can see it's, you know, 14 million, 11 million, et cetera. But, and this is a very relatively recent study about all this. But it's a lot of people using these extra features. And through all of this, you know, in terms of reaching people and dealing with people's connectivity issues, you know, the biggest problem in all of this is that we're completely bombarded by information all the time. I mean, it's really, I'm sure that all of you have this experience, except it may be after today that all of you have this experience because of BlackBerries won't have that problem anymore, because if the judge in Richmond does what they don't want, they're all going to be disconnected. But there is this issue that there's just so much information to deal with. There's also technology issues, like on my computer. Okay. You know, in the past, it used to be things like, you know, you basically had these sort of three channels to get information, and now there's a gazillion of these. I mean, there's not a single new, say, gaming platform, for example, that's coming out without some sort of connectivity built into it. You've got everything going on from new computers to PDAs being pretty ubiquitous. And just the picture at the bottom is a magazine rack. A small portion of a magazine rack, I think, in a Borders, and it's just even on the print side, you've got this huge problem that there's just so much stuff coming out there that people have to deal with. And, you know, moving forward, you know, who knows? This was from a sort of wearable computing platform that I found that, you know, I really hope isn't the future. I don't really want to look like Batman with my utility belt or something like that hanging around me. But even so, I mean, what the big picture is a new jacket by Burton, who makes the company that does all the snowboarding apparel and makes their own snowboards. And this is a jacket that's Bluetooth enabled, that you can slip your cell phone into it, you can slip your iPod into it. The controls are on the sleeves, you know, the earphones are built into the hood, so you always have it. But it's sort of this, you know, amazing platform for if you're on the ski slopes, which, based on the second slide I showed you today, I will not be again. You could possibly wear this and sort of be surrounded by media and this sort of connection all the time. So you've sort of got this issue right now of kind of signal to noise, that attention in terms of trying to reach people and deal with consumers in this sphere is that attention is their most limited resource. You know, the one thing that nobody's not making any more of right now is time. You know, everything else, it's kind of, you can get one way or another, but there's only 24 hours in a day most of the time. Sometimes it feels longer, but so trying to reach people becomes more difficult. And part of what's breaking down in this is, you know, people distrust companies a lot. They distrust advertising. You know, it's interesting to me that internet advertising is the least trusted of all of this. And trying to, you know, in terms of loyalty and in terms of people feeling an affinity to a company, it's getting more and more difficult to generate that feeling for people. One of the issues, I think, with a lot of the dot-coms is that the ones that went bust back in 2000 or so, is that they sort of expected this. They sort of expected that they would be able to hold on to these people and hold their loyalty forever. But when it came down to it, it really was more sort of features that didn't match with kind of people's lifestyles and the ways people operate. I mean, there's, you know, this is apparently the most recognizable mascot in the world from Pets.com, the talking sock puppet that many of you remember. In fact, it's just also the only corporate mascot ever to be sold to another company. Somebody else paid millions of dollars for the rights to the talking sock puppet. But, you know, but from that, I mean, it was kind of expecting people to be able to do this. And the people have started to get used to this over time, that they're starting to use it more. But when Pets.com came out, I'm sure they had this wonderful idea, like, oh, anybody can buy, there's all these pet owners, you know. And I still remember reading the business plan for them back around the time that they were on the way out. And their whole thing was, you know, there are X number of people on the internet, there are Y percentage of people who have pets, and so therefore you just add it up. If we can get a dollar from each one, you know, we'll all be gazillionaires, which is what Guy Kawasaki, who sort of is a works in venture funding and other things and used to work at Apple, talked about. He called the Chinese soda problem, which is some entrepreneur has an idea about, well, I'm going to sell soda in China. You know, there are a billion people in China. If I can capture 10% of the market, and it's 100 million people, and if I can sell them soda for $2 a can, I can make a dollar profit from that, I'll be a gazillionaire. Well, the reality is there's a lot more stuff at work to make that work. And I think with Pets.com, a lot of what their problem was is it came down to, you know, if you have a dog and your dog doesn't have food and it's chewing on your leg, what are you going to do? You know, were you going to, like, go upstairs, turn on the computer, get online, go through all that stuff, go on Pets.com, be like, sorry, puppy, you're going to have to wait like 2 days until the pet food shows up, or are you going to walk down to the local grocery store and just buy yourself some? When, you know, I think any of you have pets probably know the answer to that. But through all this is, one thing that the internet has done is sort of turns many, many things into commodity. As I talked about the sort of just the price comparison issues before, one of the issues with that is it's harder and harder to gain some sort of foothold if you don't have something to offer besides just a price differential, because now anybody can go online and research all these things, and if you're willing to mail order it, you know, something that's coming out of Nebraska is just as close as something that's coming out of New York, for example, and what you really care about is the price. And there's this move to sort of commoditizing everything because of the internet. And if you look at, you know, just even saying like Wi-Fi, this is a map I found recently of all the free wireless spots across America right now. Forget about the stuff they want to charge you for if you're in the airport or not, but there's a real move to sort of make this a ubiquitous free service for a lot of people, just because there are people who say, well, what the heck, I've got the network, I'll open it up, you know, we'll see what we can do. You know, Google right now wants to Wi-Fi-ize all of San Francisco for free. You know, in Philadelphia, where I live, you know, there's a big, as probably a lot of you know, a big initiative there to make Wi-Fi available across the entire city. Now, it's not going to be free, but it's going to be pretty low cost, and it makes a lot of sense from an economic development standpoint for the city. Because, and it also is just, you know, makes it better for the citizens who live there. But, you know, the fact that my trash can't get picked up on time a lot of the times makes me kind of wonder how well this is going to work. But I guess we'll see. And I really would hate to work the tech support desk for when that happens in Philadelphia. But there's an interesting thing that happens. And this is from, I sort of borrowed this from, there's an inventor named Ray Kurzweil, who you may have heard of at one point or another. He just wrote a book called The Singularity is Near, about kind of this logarithmic explosion in technology and innovation and where it's going. But he has a very interesting model about new technology being coming onto the market, that you've sort of got this place where, at the beginning, when something is invented, the cost is very high and the reliability is fairly low. But over time, what you've got is this crossing point where, you know, it becomes that the cost comes down, the reliability gets better, cost comes down some more, reliability gets better, and then, you know, at some point it becomes basically ubiquitous and it just becomes a commodity. I mean, I think an interesting conversation this morning about thumb drive prices, and they followed this pretty much, not as much on the reliability, because they've always kind of worked because it's a simple technology, but, you know, going from $495 3 years ago for a 1 gig thumb drive to, with the rebate, $39, I think, which I thought was just amazing. I mean, you think about that kind of power being in people's hands and the price coming down of this, but it really is, as these new technologies develop, this is, I think, a pretty accurate portrayal of how those things happen. And he goes through this whole thing too, which I think is interesting to look at in terms of technology, that he's got this idea of this life cycle, a seven-step life cycle, where you go from sort of the precursor stage where the ability to create something actually is there and maybe some visionaries see it, but you can't really do it yet. So if you think back, I mean, way back in the past, you know, Leonardo da Vinci drew pictures of helicopters back during the Renaissance, and it took a long time to get from the precursor to the invention stage on that. But then the second step being the invention stage, where the thing actually happens. You know, we've got a working prototype. There's the development stage where the technology becomes developed for market. Then you've got, when it's out in the market, this maturity stage where it really is ruling the roost in terms of its usage. It's then challenged by some new technology that has also followed this whole lifestyle cycle. The new technology is still usually very expensive and doesn't quite get in yet, but then eventually you've got this decline until the final step, which is obsolescence. You know, there's not, unless you're an enthusiast of horse racing, you probably don't have any buggy whips in your house right now, or riding crops or things like that, but that's what we don't use anymore. But still, you've got this cycle of these new technologies that are coming in. And the other point that he makes in his book, which I think is really interesting, is that this amount of time that it takes to do this has compressed significantly. I mean, something like DVDs, which are probably the quickly adopted consumer technology ever, to the internet, which is really, in 10 years. Well, when I started, my work really started when I was looking at the internet and its impact on technology back in 1991. Back then I'd tell people what I was doing and they'd be, "Inter what? Huh?" I mean, I was actually an English major, but in graduate school I started to study how this was going to impact art and literature at that time. But people didn't know what I was talking about. I got out and tried to get a job and they're like, "Huh? what are you talking about?" And now, here we have, 15 years later, that it's really ubiquitous. And there's probably nobody in this room who could even think about operating their business or their personal life without somehow being connected to the internet at some level. But that's, the amount of the amount of time you went from that point where it was really, going from the latter stages of ARPANET and things like that, when it was really a very small thing, up to now, has been amazing. Even if you look at the whole cycle, there was I should have put it in here. There was a really interesting thing I found the other day, which was the first spam that was ever sent. And the first spam ever sent, I think, was 1974. And at that point, what somebody did was they sent an email. It was a deck salesman trying to get people to come and see a new computer. And they were able to send an email message to everyone on ARPANET all at the same time. And they had all their, it was a couple hundred addresses, but it was really pretty small, going from that to, the billions of users we have right now. So, what do you do in terms of this? It really is two things. One is the idea of being able to break out from the competition and from being able to do something that other people can't do, and then also connecting with people, And in this, I think that there are kind of four imperatives from a business standpoint that need to be done. There's the differentiation angle, connection with people, engaging them, and then one I think that gets left out a lot, which is delighting them. And differentiation is sort of, I run a design school, so I have to think this way, but there's this kind of idea of great design combined with, and design can be many levels. I like to say that design with a big D, not graphic design about what things necessarily look like, but also how they behave and how they operate, along with an understanding of the customer. And there's a great quote I love from Tom Peters, which is, "Design is the principal difference between love and hate when it comes to products and services," I think. And I think if you look at this, it really is. I drive a Honda Element, okay? And I've had it described to me as a Soviet ice cream truck or a milk truck or things like that. It's really kind of, I like, one of the things I like having it is that it really is kind of a litmus test for people. I can show them my car, and if they're like, "Ew," I'm like, "I don't really want to talk to you," which eliminates a lot of chit-chat and things like that. But it's a real kind of litmus test kind of vehicle because it does have a very distinctive design and people either love it or hate it. I've never met anybody who's kind of ambivalent about it. I can do with whatever. But that happens all the time. But it's not just what it looks like, but I think when you're looking at products, it's how they behave as well. I mean, if you look at something like, okay, these are sunglasses from Oakley that have an MP3 player built into it. For me, I think these things are horribly ugly. I don't know anybody who owns them. In fact, I think their sales are very poor. But if you look at something like the iPod, which has, I think, a 88 or 90% market share right now, what's the difference in these things? I think that you can point to design in all facets of things, why this is better, because and why people buy it. You know, it's simple to use, it's easy to operate, it looks beautiful, it behaves itself, it integrates with their music store they have, all of those things. And all of those things are what really I consider design in the largest sense, but it just works. Because it's not, it also proves to me that people don't necessarily buy on specs when they're looking at things and comparing them. I mean, I recently had to buy a new cell phone, and I was on the Verizon site. Anybody from Verizon in here? Okay. This is just a bit of free advice. When I was comparing the phones, because there's so many of them, it was very confusing to me because so many of them have the same features, and there's the compare thing where you can check a couple, and what you get is specs next to each other. And that I didn't find that very helpful. And I think about the example of the iPod in terms of, you know, there are other MP3 players which are cheaper, you know, and hold more music or whatever, but people don't really buy them too much. They buy these. And because it just works better. I wanted to see links to you know, things like more consumer comparisons and things like that. So just, I've been a subscriber for a long time, so don't get me wrong. Still like the company. And then connecting with people is, you know, from a standpoint of marketing to people or even giving them customer support or things like that is, you know, being everywhere where people are, because this is becoming increasingly difficult, that it's not just, you can't just call people on the phone or you can't just send them an email, but you sort of have to do all those things and also be other places where they might be in order to connect with them, because that whole thing back to the idea of attention, it is tougher because people are looking at different things. I mean, I used to work in advertising for I guess about 9 or 10 years. And, you know, it used to be that it was very easy. It was like, oh, we want to place an ad. Okay, we'll go and we'll, you know, put some ads in this newspaper, put some ads on television. We're set. Now it's, you know, where the heck do you put it? I mean, I turn on my digital cable at home. I've got 400 channels staring me in the face. And knowing where people are in that is very difficult. And I remember sitting at a media, the 4A's, which is the Advertising Association of America, sitting at their meeting in Florida a couple years ago in Orlando, and there's this old crusty guy who's a CEO of one of the big advertising agencies, and he sits up there, and they were doing a panel of sort of emeritus CEOs, who was the ex-CEO, and somebody said, well, what's your biggest regret in your business? And he just kind of looked at the person and said, that this damn internet came in before I was able to retire, which I think, you know, I can kind of see how people would think that way. But and I think that looking at the power of being able to connect to people, I think, is very interesting, too. You know, these are statistics from MySpace, which I don't know if any of you, it's one of these social networking sites where you can sign up and invite friends in, and they all sort of network through each other. And, you know, I don't know if any of you use MySpace, but it's become a huge force, especially like on the campus where I work. It's like everybody's like, why aren't you on MySpace? Like, because I don't want you to know every detail of my life, kids, go away. But I mean, there's some statistics from where how it's doing it. You know, 150,000 users during the first half of November. This is November 2005. You know, 24.2 million unique users in October. I don't have to read all this, but the point about this is that it is a huge force, and it's growing really rapidly because people really love this idea of sort of being able to connect to each other all the time. And I forget who's coming out with this, but there is a couple phone companies that are coming out with this MySpace phone where, you know, you'll never be away from this. You don't have to go to your computer anymore. Now you can post to and get messages from other people in MySpace right through your mobile phone. So you really are truly connected, you know, constantly to this network of other people. All of these other things, and I apologize for some of you for putting that Skype logo up there, because I'm sure some of you don't like it too much, but I think it's an interesting trend to look at how it's being used. And it's also being used now in really fascinating ways. There's a student radio station in Philadelphia that has sort of a weekly report on what's going on in Iraq, and what they do is they go onto Skype, and because it has everybody's location and whether they speak English or not, they'll just randomly start calling people in Iraq who happen to show up on this and put them on the air and say, you know, tell me what's going on in your town or whatever. But, you know, the ability to do something like that is just astounding. That didn't even exist a few years ago. You know, you've got all the things of the different types of mobile video that are coming out. Again, you know, I mentioned the iTunes store. You've got things like, you know, being able to download songs now through your cell phone, so you have this constant connection to things all the time. But this idea is that there's all this media converging in one place. People are getting used to be able to get this wherever they want, and they can get it wherever they are at most, you know, at most times. So engaging with people, you know, really means real life usefulness is important. People really want to have things that can help them in their real life. Entertainment, I think, is something that gets left behind a lot. And actually, there's a study that just came out from the Pew project for the Internet and American Life that was fascinating, is that the number of people who report that they go online just to be entertained, kind of randomly surf, has doubled in a year. It used to be 24 million, according to their study. It's now about 40 million people who report that they regularly do this, which is a major change, because it used to be, and as a former and sort of current, I guess, Internet consultant, I used to always tell people, you know, people are there, they're very goal-directed, they just want to be able to get things done and move on. Well, it turns out that there's a heck of a lot of people out there who also want to be able to be entertained. And also, it's kind of it allows you to engage people in a way that isn't necessarily it's really something that allows you to engage people at sort of an emotional level too. And also going along with that is this idea of an experience. It's not just a utilitarian thing. And if you think of Amazon, for example, if all Amazon was a big database of books that came out, you know, text format in rows and columns, you said what you wanted, said we have five of them, click here to order, it wouldn't be anywhere near as popular as it is, because it's much more than that. I mean, it sort of replicates in the best way possible online the experience of shopping in an actual bookstore. You can browse and get recommendations from people and even be able to sort of like page through the book and read some of that. And that's what sets it apart from just, oh, if we're just going to sell books online, we're just going to throw up a database and people can buy stuff. I got one of my early schoolings in this I got was when I was working for a big grocery store chain down in Maryland, up in Maryland from here. I'm sort of used to saying the other way. But I remember we were talking about all this online shopping and all this stuff, and there was this old crusty guy who had sort of been one of their marketing managers for years, and he looks at me, he's like, we don't make any money from people buying off of shopping lists. That's not where the money comes from. The money comes from impulse buying, because you got a nice end cap or you can pull something out or put the candy in the aisle next to the kid who's standing there bugging their mother to buy it. He's like, that's the kind of thing. Until you can replicate that on the internet, the online grocery shopping thing isn't going to really take off. And it was actually a fairly prescient thing to say, because he said that in, I guess it was 96 or 97, and it turned out, well, there was a lot of problems with that. Mainly, I think, a lot of other reasons, but one main reason I think was that experience issue. And then delight too, that if you're marketing to people or want to sell them things, you can't underestimate the power of just emotionally connecting with them through delight. I mean, if you look at like the Aeron chair, for example, I mean, it was back in the .com era, you were nobody unless you had that. And a lot of that experience is you can probably have the same, you know, you could engineer something that looked like kind of the one of the chairs in here that provided the same kind of support, but that itself is really interesting. You look at Target. You know, one thing that has really driven Target strategy has been to say, we're going to do something more than just sell you a bunch of stuff for cheap. I mean, at the same time, Walmart is sort of taking the opposite way and has been also additionally successful because they've said, that's what we're here for. We're here to sell you stuff for cheap in mass quantities, and we're going to be open 24 hours a day. We're going to be there. And Target, especially if you look at their advertising and things like that, has become, you know, much more. They brought in designers to make things more exciting, I guess. There's the OXO Good Grips, the peeler, which was, I think, the first product they came out with. You know, yeah, they're ergonomic, but there's also something about them that's just you hold them in your hand and it's like, wow, that's really cool. It's really nice. You know, there's no reason that iMac needs to look like that. You know, there is none. From an engineering standpoint, you could have made many different choices with that, but one thing that they did with that was make it look like something else. Dell has the same thing. They have the whole XPS line of computers and laptops right now, and they've got all sorts of, you know, metal things on the outside and blinky lights and stuff, most of which really serve no major function, but people like them because they're cool. I mean, if you break out your Dell Dimension XPS laptop at my school when you're sitting down with people and you're, you know, an 18-year-old, it's like, wow, you know, I want that. And certainly you don't care about the specs at that point. And then to me, I thought this was just a really fascinating thing that at the Super Bowl in 2001, the most rewatched part, meaning people who recorded the Super Bowl and could watch anything, any play, any, you know, any part of the game, what did they rewatch the most? This Britney Spears commercial. You know, and from a standpoint of communicating with people, that to me is fascinating, that you can create a thing that makes people want to watch that more than the game. Now, there's, you know, some obvious reasons in that, and I, you know, you don't need to go into that, but it really is, that I think is an amazing thing. So, you know, where to next in this, or what have all these trends in terms of communicating with people really come down to? And there are these moves within this and ways of thinking about things that I think are important to look at. There's this kind of this move from this implicit to explicit. You have to be more clear about what it is you're trying to communicate with people and not just not just imply it, but to really say, here's why I'm better, I'm standing out. You know, there's this idea, too, that in all this, the time between idea and implementation is becoming shorter and shorter all the time. You know, sitting on things and not getting them out to market fast enough is really a difficult thing, because there's this expectation that things are shrinking down in that. This idea of moving from a broadcast model to an interaction model when communicating with people, you know, it does have to be about, you know, really a two-way form of communication, because that's the way that people are expecting to communicate with each other. This move from the factory to the desktop, that products and services can be much more easily created now on the desktop, and then starting, you know, this is sort of what happened with the whole dot-com explosion, if it got a little bit out of hand, was this idea that, hey, I can just start a business now basically using my brain and the desktop. Publication versus streaming. I see this a lot of times, and any of you who, I don't know if there's any kind of communications people in the room or not, but, you know, a lot of companies who want to do, or anybody, or any organization, my school is guilty about this too, who put out newsletters and things like this, there's this tendency to want to create them as these precious objects that are the same thing that if you were creating a print newsletter which had to go to a printer and couldn't be changed, when in fact the expectation that people have right now of communications is this constant stream of information. It's not about fussing over the corporate newsletter for, you know, a quarter until it gets perfect, but it's more pushing out information on a constant basis. And you look at the popularity of something like blogging, this is really what blogging is about. Nobody is sitting there crafting these perfect treatises that come out every other week. They're just writing quick little things and pointing things to people on a really regular basis. Moving from, and I mentioned this before, moving from thinking of communications as something that really is communicating between places to communicating between people. And it's a subtle difference, but it's a major difference, because you're not talking about just connecting with, you know, knowing the situation you're connecting with, but people can sort of be anywhere in all this. And I think if, you know, I don't know if any of you have used, Google has a text messaging based search right now, which is just wonderful, because you can basically text Google with a search, like if you were looking for, I wanted to find out what the weather was going to be like when I got back today. So I went on. I have it in my contacts manager, and I just did weather and my zip code, and within about 5 seconds, Google sends me a text message back that says exactly what the weather is, and I can get that back whenever. And it's really amazing to think of what the possibilities are if you really kind of disconnect yourself from people have to be in certain places to communicating back and forth between people wherever they are. And a lot of this is really about the experience. It's not just the specs of how things happen, but it's also sort of the total experience, everything from customer service to the product itself to its reliability, et cetera. Really is not something that anybody wants to deal with anymore. And I do have to, I'll give props to Verizon now. When I was on the site, I let it sit there for a while because I got distracted by a phone call, and all of a sudden this messaging box pops up and says, hey, we noticed you've been sitting on the site not doing anything. Are you having a problem? And here's a customer service person right there willing to talk to me, which I thought, you know, this speaks directly to that exactly. It was a really, I think, a really brilliant tactic. It was a little unnerving the first time it happened to me, but it was still, I think, a really brilliant tactic. And that really what a lot of this comes down to is it's not necessarily about the actual technology, but about what it does. And there is a big difference here, because it's not, people don't, you know, those of us who are kind of more techie people in the room will get really excited about some sort of whatever new product. Wow, isn't this really cool?
If we had great.
But really what, you know, for the most part, what consumers want is just something that gets the job done. I mean, I bought an Apple II Plus
interview.
I guess back in like 1983.
Hi, I'm
here. I still
have
the manuals that came with it, because it was a computer that also came with the wiring diagram, the assembly language printout of the operating system, and all that stuff. You know, you do that now to consumers and their heads would explode. They wouldn't be able to deal with that. And, you know, I have to say, a lot of times people really fall down on this
with the interviewer.
In one place where I think that
next we're going to move on to Julia's interview. This is our last interview today. And Julia is a senior in economics applying for a corporate finance position.
I've bought phones before when I got the manual and it was about that thick. And all I really wanted to be able to do was, you know, get on the internet or do something like that. I couldn't figure it out. And I always sort of think about this in terms of technology, like with my mom test. Like, okay, if I gave this thing to my mom, would she, and my mother's not dumb, would she be able to figure it out? And I've, you know, done my own single person experiments before, and usually not. But, and throughout all this, too, about not getting too wrapped up in the fact of just the actual specs and the technology of things, but also looking at what people do, because while technology changes really quickly, people change very slowly. It takes a long time to really initiate these kind of big changes. And
to
typically,
Julia's interview, this is our last interview today, and Julia is a senior in economics applying for a corporate finance
and communications devices amongst the, you know, sort of 13, or I should go back to that other slide, from 8 to 18, those people catch on really well. I mean, any of you who have small children or are grandparents of small children or whatever, you know, it's amazing. I remember sitting there and watching my daughter, you know, 2 years old, moving the mouse around the screen, you know, and I thought back to my time when I went from, you know, DOS to Windows, and I had to use the little programs that sort of
taught you how to
use the mouse. It was kind of hard. She sits down at 2
for
and
being
she's
with us
just
today.
On
Thank you for having me.
You know, and even
me.
Doing stuff like she disappeared from the room one day, and I hear the some game going on in the other room, and she, before she could read, knew enough to go in,
today you may
know,
say
fire
that
up
this
the browser,
goal,
type in,
a year into the company, you may say, you know,
com or something, and start
I've changed
playing
that
games.
Goal,
and
or
you
I
think
changed
about
the focus
those,
of my career,
know,
just
the world that those people
to
are coming
you
up
in
with, and the world that you know, looks like most of us
very
have come
important
up with. It took us a long time to really
well,
integrate all this stuff.
Much.
They're not going
to
know.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to interview with us today.
My pleasure.
You know, it really is something to think about this, not get too wrapped up in the technology, but really what it can do. So on that, that's it. That's how to get a hold of me. I'll be happy to take any questions. I guess we've got until what time?
10:15.
So, yeah. So there's about 25 minutes for questions if anybody has them.
Hi, Julia.
I was Googling the other day and I realized that I was a lot like that chicken I used to see. The you know where it'd go up and it'd peck a button and the pelt would fall out and eat it. So I was like, I don't know the psychological terms, I guess, but being some sort of schedule and reinforcement was going for me to leap from thing to thing.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about that in context of what you were saying about entertainment and also getting
all right.
What I realized was driving me was not the message I was
Julia saying, used a lot of the same examples.
Was it something that would seem like it would be something that would, you know, make some sort of chemicals cascade in my brain and I'd go, oh yeah. But it didn't have anything to do with focusing on a product.
Right. Well, I think that part of that too is the random schedules of reinforcement being more effective than regular reinforcement because, you know, you probably also got like those stupid link farm sites that have links that don't do you any good. I think that
with us today. I hope that you had
sort
a chance to learn both from their
bringing
positive
the entertainment aspect into it. There's a lot more companies doing that on their websites. I mean, I think that there's a company, Burger King, and many of you may have seen this or not. They did a campaign with this subservient chicken. Did any of you see the subservient chicken website?
Forward with
and that
an
was
answer
like a really
that
entertaining
somewhat
thing that
was able to be
well
related to the question asked.
Like,
she talked like about what she developmentally learned.
And you could type messages. Okay. you could type messages into this website like, you know, I want you to dance. And the way that they would get in the program, they had actual video of this chicken guy dancing. You know, and this thing really sucks people in. There's a lot of moves right now going on with advertising where people create sort of games that are also ads. I'm not cheating on kids' sites all the time. Every game on this game is really an ad for the television show. It's in there. But I think it's that the searching part, and it's actually, if you like doing that and just kind of going around, there's a great plugin for Firefox called Stumbler, which just gives you highly rated sites sort of at random. That's how I want to put myself on that.
I'm not
going to
like it,
man.
It's just a
great plugin. Well, there, I think there actually is, at the University of Maryland, I think there's a person there. The college is the anthropology who actually specializes in internet addiction, so I could find, I can't remember
in
what her name is. So
and that you enjoyed this lecture. We'll talk to you soon.
Exactly.
Don't eat no ugly chicken.
Yes.
Sean, can you go back to your engagement slide?
Okay.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to class. Today is a very exciting class. We are going
yes,
to...
One?
Yeah. In the category... I was a professor.
Is that installed in your finger, or...?
Interesting categories here. Why don't you have the categories essential, required? Is there any engagement...
for taking the time to interview with us today.
My pleasure.
Julia used a lot.
from the demand side, for example, you go to the consumer price index, you got, I think it's 12 categories.
Mm-hmm.
And under those 12 categories, there are subcategories, and under the subcategories, you get about 72. And I used to, when I was teaching, say to my students, show me one category of those 72 where the internet is essential or required for the well-being.
Current student standing as well as their major. And then we're also fortunate to have Colby and Ifwa, who have. Today on our agenda, we're going to have mock interviews with Bryson Ridgway, David Vargas, Ryan Tseng, Leah Gibbons, and Julia Pelfi for full-time positions. And you can see here their current student standing as well as their major.
I think it's something like email.
And then we're also fortunate to have Colby and
essential to be, well, from just say from a business
the proper,
I think,
more,
operating
more effective.
Okay.
We're going to have mock interviews with Bryson Ridgway. David Vargas.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about your question because I think that it.
Have mock interviews with Bryson Ridgway, Ryan Tseng, Leah Gibbons.
From the standpoint of communicating with other people, it's why email is the most popular application because it is, I think it has become essential pretty much for a lot of people to be able to communicate with that. Well, maybe I'll yield to the economics professor in the back because he probably knows more than me.
Let's go to your 72 categories in the consumer price index. How many of those goods and services would you say are essential or required? Well, my question is, I mean, we're not Chinese peasants. We're not spending a large fraction of our budget on things that we need to survive.
This conversation takes us to a question that doesn't show it shows up in regulation a lot.
Okay.
That is, you know, we're talking here about what are the modes by which customers get to do things, and there are several options out there. But where do the consumer issues arrive in this? If the world is changing, going this way, and consumers are doing these kinds of things, where's consumer protection come in, and who's playing that role?
Well, there actually is. Consumer Reports started a separate organization, sort of separate, called Consumer Web Watch, about 4 years ago. That actually does look a lot at, because their focus was really on issues of trust. You know, is it safe for me to buy online? Is it something to do like that? And you know, interestingly enough, from my standpoint as dean of a design school, the fascinating thing to me in their study they did about trust on the internet was that design is the number one indicator that people use to determine whether or not they should trust a website before buying something from it. But I was thinking about this conversation. This was fun to watch. But two things I wanted to say. One is that you know there is kind of the ridiculous level sometimes of use of the internet. I mean, I I did some consulting work for Baltimore Gas and Electric years ago, and I remember they were all excited because they said, we can put outages on our website. I'm like, well, that's interesting. If my power's out, how am I going to be, how useful is this going to be to me? But also, I mean, to your point, I think that if you look at the most successful things online, the things that work best online are the things that can really only work online. Take eBay, for example. eBay cannot exist in the physical world, period. It can't. I mean, you could kludge it together by doing some sort of weird telephone thing where people were sending in their bids, but it can't exist except online. You know, whether that's essential to anyone's life, I really doubt, you know, unless you're going to die of, you know, tchotchke withdrawal or something if you can't get your thrift store stuff all the time. But I think that that's when you, if you look at the things that work best online and the businesses that have survived the best are ones that can only exist online.
The idea of having needs to be filled, I know you're very practical if you're trying to actually earn a living by selling things, but I don't want to get that in the way. But I can't get over the correlation between like a Maslowian hierarchy of needs and the idea that we're going from a hierarchical communication structure to a distributed network structure, and something's emerging. And I don't know what that underlying thing is, but I think it also throws into doubt that you can use the kind of Maslowian hierarchical template for deciding how to design your products. And I think it has something to do with the redefinition of community, the relationship to time and space, and the need to have these kind of contacts, but also to be able, I don't know where it's going, but the thing that keeps coming to me is the fact that we've gone from this hierarchical way of defining truth, delegating authority, to a more horizontal. I think it's the race is on and something's going
to
emerge.
Yeah, I think it's a little too early still to be able to tell what that is. But I don't really know. I agree with you. I don't really know what it is. But if you look at the blogging phenomenon, I mean, that is something. It's a completely different way of publishing information. And, you know, I don't think it's all that different. People talk about blogging as being some great invention that happened in the last couple of years. I mean, people have always had sort of home pages that they posted stuff to. But, you know, just in journalism alone and what's happened in journalism and how that's working, going from this very sort of tightly controlled hierarchy where you've got, you know, New York Times and everybody else on the top, you put it on the internet, and one person's blog is sort of, in some ways, in terms of access, equal to the New York Times. I mean, there's the thing that I think, you know, journalists can argue about whether or not, you know, the filter function of a journalist and an editor, et cetera, makes a difference, which I think it does. But, you know, from some point, there's this flattening that's happening of things because of that. So a question.
About 5 years ago, I came to this meeting, and communications expert said in 5 years a phone on the wall in your home will be unusual. And I laughed. We all laughed. Ha! But, you know, it stretched our minds. So tell us what life's going to be like in 5 years.
I think the phone on the wall will pretty much be gone for the most part. I would agree with that. I think that the big change that I think is really interesting to look at is the portability of media. You know, because you think about the fact, like with radio, for example. I mean, radio is a great example of this, that, you know, listenership has been declining. I don't have the statistic up here, but listenership has been declining pretty steadily. Part of that
and career development you're in. You may want to take notes on the various types of interviews.
Junk on Clear Channel stations all the time, which I apologize if there's anybody in here from there. But then if you start thinking about where the technology could go, that once I think that some sort of, I don't know if it's Wi-Fi or not, but some sort of wireless internet connectivity will be fairly universal in 5 years, at least in urban areas, I think. And you think about the capability that starts
for us,
to give
so
you. That if you
thanks
had a
again, folks, who volunteered.
That was, say, like
today on our agenda, we're going to have mock interviews with Bryson Ridgway, Ryan Tseng, Leah Givens, and Julia Pelfi for full-time positions. And you can see here their current student standing as well as their major. And then we're also fortunate to have Colby and Ifwa, who have done some interviews for us specifically.
Once you have access to everything, you can't.
We're going to have mock interviews with Bryson Ridgway, Ryan Tseng, Leah Givens.
But I think that the biggest move is to sort of being always on all the time and having that kind of connectivity. But I do think I think that's absolutely right, that the phone on the wall will pretty much go away. I mean, people that I know, more and more of them are ditching their landline phones and just operating on their cell phones, which, you know, is a pretty interesting trend, I think. Because it's weird, because I was thinking about, I mean, it says too much about my high school years, but I was thinking about my high school years where, you know, you go out on a Saturday, it's like, oh, I think there's a party somewhere, but I don't know what it is. And you'd spend all night driving around and driving around and driving around and never finding it. The kids today have no experience with that. They don't, because it's like, hey, where are you? Oh, okay, that's where you are. I'll go right there. So there's that kind of compression that's going on. I don't know, it's a big question to answer in a short amount of time, but I think that the major shift that we'll see is to sort of wireless everything at all times and all the possibilities that engenders. Because even, you know, right now, just looking at things like, you know, I feel like a shill for Verizon today, like the VCast thing that they're doing, or the music downloading that Sprint's doing, for example, or some of the other video things that I guess Singular does it too. Think about that in 5 years with the pace of technology and being able to reach consumers with video content, which is very compelling, sort of everywhere at all times. I think you're seeing on the internet, there's been a huge explosion in online video that has, you know, gone from relatively small usage in the last couple of years to now it's almost everywhere. I mean, more and more people are turning to video online. I think that there will be a major issue coming along with cable, you know, the ability to basically be able to get any of your media you want through cable, you know, because you basically, with like IPTV and other technologies, you basically, why would you need to watch, you know, why do I need to watch Comcast on my TV anymore? I can get, you know, I'll be able to at some point, because people have done it, Comedy Central's doing it, I think Nickelodeon's doing it, and they're just starting to experiment now with delivering real programming online, because now the technology is getting good enough that you can watch it full screen on your computer, which is already a higher resolution than your television. You think about that, and you think about, well, moving that from where we are to wireless, and how then it's like you can watch this stuff anywhere. I don't really know where it's going exactly, but I do see that major trend in kind of being able to access anything and anybody at any time, anywhere, I think is the really big thing that's going to change. Yes?
Business models or pricing models from the carriers changing over time, because there's all these new cool technologies, but the pricing doesn't always seem to be what
makes it. So yeah, thanks again, folks who volunteered.
You haven't decided, is this worth 25 cents for me to use to send this to
somebody?
Right.
Today on our agenda, we're...
I think that it's really... The question of business models is a really interesting one, because... You look at the music industry, for example. I mean, the whole fight right now against file sharing and downloading music online is really
for us. So thanks again, folks who volunteered.
What they were selling was
today
music.
On our agenda, we're going to have mock interviews with Bryson Ridgway, Ryan Tseng, Leah Givens, and Julia Pelfi for full-time positions. And you can see here their current student standing, as well as their major.
There really is no way.
And then we're also fortunate to have Colby and Ifwa, who have done some interviews for us specific to internships.
But you look at the success of the iTunes store. If you price things right and allow people to buy whatever you want, well, there's a billion of these songs sold in 3 years. And I think that the, you know, the difficulty that
notes on the various types
is,
of interviews,
one,
as well as
the
questions. All of these interviews, though, are
CDs to people, in which if you buy CDs, you know
Hi.
That for the most part, there's
start
two
off today
songs on the
with
CD, and the
Bryson
rest
Ridgway
of, you know, stinks. But you're sort of forced to buy the whole thing, and so the model becomes difficult when you can individually pick and choose your own songs. I think the same thing goes for cable. There's a whole fight over, you know, the a la carte cable plans right now, which is very difficult for people to work with, because the plans are built about around that. Things like sending pictures, I think over time consumers are not going to want to pay those kind of prices. They just won't use it. Because I look back to the
Hi, and we're here today with Bryson Ridgway
in the UK. You know, you had to pay by the minute for internet access all the time. So who
thank
the
heck you so much.
It took a long
thank
time
you very much.
People before it became
all right to give you some
to do it. And I know, you know, there's sort of discussion right now about
and minimizing his own experiences, and you want to be careful of that.
Access
all right, let's take a minute to watch,
you know, broadband and video and things like that. People are using a lot more bandwidth than they were using before, but I think that ultimately, while it may make money now, ultimately it's a really bad strategy, because it may make usage go down because people don't want to pay those kind of prices. So, you know, maybe advertising supported models become more popular. I mean, I just actually saw a study about mobile sort of other services, you know, sort of more multimedia services. And consumers have said, you know, for almost at least in this one study, the majority of people said, yes, I would accept advertising in, say, my video content I download on my phone, so I didn't have to pay a higher price for that. I mean, people are used to kind of an advertising-supported model, and it's, you know, I've just joked with people before that, you know, the entire future is advertising-supported, because people got so addicted on the internet to getting free content all the time that it's kind of hard to drag them back now to not doing that. So the pricing models need to be looked at. But I think, you know, not charging people... Charging people all the time kind of will drive down their usage of this stuff. Or charging them too much. I mean, maybe there's a sweet spot that you can hit that it becomes... I think of the iTunes store, 99 cents for some reason seemed to be the magic number that has made that thing work, where there's all these other places that have, you know, different pricing models. You don't know how much things are going to cost, et cetera. So, you know, getting it down, there seems to be, I don't know what it is all the time, and I think it varies across what it is you're trying to sell. There seems to be a sweet spot where usage will be very high, and the cost is low enough for people not to think about it too much. So, though it does make me nervous talking about that with economists in the room, so I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. Yes?
If you were Bell South, Verizon, Sprint, or any of the other network companies, what would you be doing to ensure that you've got a good business model for the consumers who are focused this direction?
I think keeping, I think there's been a lot of good moves to this, like sort of all the in-network plans I think are really smart, you know, because you can drive things cheaper. I think that looking at more usefulness and making things that people want to buy and not, you know, not being so tied to some sort of stupid short-term thinking. I look at like the rocker phone that came out from Motorola was stupid. It holds 100 songs. Who the hell wants 100 songs? You know, people have iPods. I got, you know, 3,000 songs on my iPod, and you know, as a result of that, it didn't go too well. And the whole reason the decision was made was more about Apple not wanting this new phone, the iTunes phone, to go and compete with its existing products. But in the short term, I think it was dumb. I mean, I think that keeping unlimited access for single set prices on the internet is vital to this whole thing, because as the short term it may work to help curtail some of the prices. Over the long term, it's going to I would think would drive usage down. And I know that's a big discussion right now, and I think it's idiotic to even think that way. And I think looking at more advertising-supported models or things that might be more, I think advertising-supported for a lot, especially content stuff, makes a lot of sense. But the problem with the advertising-supported model is it scares the living bejesus out of the advertisers and the advertising agencies, because people are so used to kind of the collective fiction of Nielsen ratings and things like that. When you go to something you can actually measure each hit on something, it becomes really scary, because all of a sudden as an agency you have to say, well, you know, we told you were going to reach, you know, 100,000 people, and you really only reached 50,000 people, and it's provable. So they don't, you know, they're very, a lot of times kind of scared to use that, because it used to be, well, the newspaper has a circulation of 250,000, so therefore you're reaching 250,000 people. You can't do that anymore. So is there a question in the back? Or?
Looking forward to the next 5 years and the completion of broadband and consumers using just more bandwidth because of, you know, things like podcasts and video casting and everything else. Do you see, and this is more, I guess, an engineering thing, do you see the potential for the networks not being able, you know, bottleneck trying to occur as far as all these systems are using more and more bandwidth?
I'm not an engineer, so it probably is a little bit beyond me on that. But I do think that, I mean, my understanding is that the capacity is there in general. I think that it is going to put a lot of demand on things. I mean, any of you who work in a, you know, if you work in a big company or a small company or a university, you know, you sit there and you get on your LAN around lunchtime and the whole thing just is bogged down because everybody's surfing the internet. You know, but moving towards that and looking at technologies to increase that, I mean, not everything has to be wired necessarily. But it's not, I mean, it's definitely not going down. The trend vector is there. It's not like this is, you know, it's plateauing somewhat, but it's not like it's going to not keep going up, because as more and more things get connected, there's going to be more and more demand on this. And, I, you know, you can either say, well, we're going to decrease demand by increasing prices for this stuff, which might be a way to slow that down. You know, maybe it's a short-term thing that you decrease prices where you, and where you decrease usage in order to have enough time to keep upgrading the system all the time, but that's kind of difficult too. But I don't know, I don't see it going down any other way. I mean, you can look at, there's so many of these technologies now that you look at that, you know, maybe you can't pick the company or the exact version of the technology that's going to succeed, but if you look at something like, you know, like podcasting and video casting, for example, people love it. It's not going to go away. It's not some sort of like trend or fad or something. There's only going to be more demand for that stuff and more demand for multimedia content. I mean, I know that the last couple of things I've seen about broadband access is, yeah, broadband adoption is starting to slow down a little bit, but I just can't think of a scenario where it's going to stop, you know, where it's going to plateau and start going down. I can't see it happening. It's not going to happen.
Where do you see wireline in terms of... You know, in terms of telecommunications, with it changing, where do you see it fitting in for people to use? Is it kind of getting, is it being shunted into one particular arena?
I think so. I mean, we've got the, you know, there's the whole rural issue that's going to make it difficult to ever for that to go away, and getting access to those places. But, you know, I think of something like, and I know why there's been a lot of controversy, but there's a lot of talk, like in Philadelphia, with all the Wi-Fi, you know, Wi-Fiing the whole city. That, you know, it's really frightening. If you're a competition, who, you know, I think it's Millennium Cable is the Philadelphia's cable network. If I was them, I'd be scared out of my mind, because all of a sudden, why would anybody be buying high-speed access from you when they can buy it from somewhere else? I mean, in terms of the trend vectors, I can't see a scenario where wireless isn't going to keep increasing and wired isn't going to keep decreasing. I mean, I can't imagine why that would happen.
I think as long as it's more than the one, maybe alternative Linux technologies, like triggering on that. That's what Philadelphia is doing. They're in the Linux platform, they're in the Wi-Fi spots. That's only going to explode, because you look at a country like New Zealand, where 50% of the country is wireless internet. The whole southern region. France already has a new car now. They just came out with it to access the Linux network so you can travel over its weather and everything. And it's only going to explode. And so it's going to work the same thing with Verizon or Sprint or whatever. So they set up these Linux towers, or I don't know what they have to use. They use existing towers and transmitters. They basically just lease the space from there. And it's going to be like, I guess, kind of roaming on a cell phone.
Yeah, well,
I mean, rural areas.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the other things, the question of 5 years from now, is that the internet becomes a channel for everything. Because if you think about it, just for the sake of argument, imagine that there was ubiquitous Wi-Fi access somewhere. Well, why couldn't somebody come out with basically the Skype phone that doesn't use cellular technology, that uses Wi-Fi with Skype over the internet, and all of a sudden you bypassed all of that other stuff? I mean, that's something to think about. So I guess the time's up.
Yep, time's up. So join me in thanking Sean for it.
Thank you.
We'll take about a 15-minute break. We'll be back up here to talk about the telecommunications competition.
Set up this other one.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Well, it's fun to do that. It's fun to get the what 5 years question.
Yeah. Thank you. You were very nicely done.
Thank you.
Lots of big thoughts.
Yeah, I know. It's an awful lot. Like Rosanna saw me this morning. Your presentation's 84 slides.
You know?
No, I know.
Oh, well, see, that's the difference. I like to keep it for one thought per slide. So.
Mark, I am assuming, but I'll just say it, that I am actually free to step away from this. It's not being recorded here, is it?
Yeah, it is being recorded.
I'm a bit of a raw. It would be great because I'm by nature a roamer.
Yeah.
Or you can carry that with you, you don't mind. But I'll try to get it.
Rob Fox, he's brought education.